The second hard sound also has two components, both of which should be audible in most normal subjects. The first component is caused by aortic valve closure, and the second by pulmonary valve closure. These are frequently referred to as A2 and P2 respectively, and this abbreviation will be used in future on this record. It must be clearly understood that P2 does not refer to the second sound in the pulmonary area, but to the pulmonary component of the second hard sound, irrespective of the site at which it is heard. Similarly, A2 refers to the aortic component of the second sound wherever it is audible. Due to the higher pressure in the aorta as compared to the pulmonary artery, aortic closure is louder than pulmonary closure, and it is usually only the aortic component of the second heart sound which is normally present over the whole precordium. Listen again to the recording of the normal heart with the loud physiological third heart sound. It is taken at the apex. Only A2 is audible, and thus the second sound appears single at this site. The pulmonary component is often audible only in the second left interspace, and consequently the normal reduplication of the second heart sound is usually best heard at this site. Whereas the timing of aortic closure is for practical purposes unaffected by respiration, the increased stroke volume of the right ventricle after inspiration results in delay of pulmonary closure. Thus, the normal second sound is clearly split in inspiration, but apparently single in expiration. This is illustrated by a recording taken in quiet respiration in a 7-year-old child with a normal heart and innocent systolic murmur. As a sinus arrhythmia is present, the heart rate is faster after inspiration, and this can be used to time the phases of respiration. During inspiration, the second heart sound is clearly reduplicated, but appears single immediately after expiration. Stenosis or left bundle branch block, which cause delay of aortic valve closure, will result in so-called paradoxical splitting of the second sound. In other words, the second sound is split during expiration when P2 precedes the delayed A2, whereas with inspiration P2 moves later as usual, and consequently the degree of splitting is either decreased or abolished at this time.
Listening to various locked grooves put together by your friends right here at Freeform Radio WFMU, and also by a bunch of Washington DC artists out of the District of Noise Sonic Circuits compilation and the Heart Auscultations record. I think there's a boombox stuck in here as well. We heard Funkadelic performing Maggot Brain live in Rochester, Michigan, September 12th, 1971. And we heard Golden Earring at the top of that set from 1973's Moon Tan. The track was called Vanilla Queen. My name is Scott. Thanks for hanging with me today. Hope you had a nice 3-day weekend. Happy Memorial Day, friends. And I do look forward to seeing you next week with my friends and guests performing live, Crying Laughing, out of Baltimore. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, worldwide online at WFMU.org. See you next week. Bye.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour. Thanks so much for joining. I've got a really interesting interview for you this time. It's with David Greenwood, a debut novelist, who's going to be talking about his new novel. It's called The Cloud Intern, which is a dystopian sci-fi movie, not a movie. I'm so used to saying dystopian sci-fi movie as a phrase. That just came right out. No, this is a dystopian sci-fi novel. Maybe someday it'll be made into a movie, but for now it's a book. And as we cover at the beginning of the interview, it's a little bit of a different take on your standard dystopia for a couple of reasons. One is that there is a utopia in the middle of the story. And second is that there is a tech billionaire that Greenwood, as he describes in our conversation that you'll hear, wants us to have some sympathy for this tech billionaire. And I had mixed feelings about that, which we get into. And in fact, the conversation broadens out from the book itself to David's and my own various views on technology and the future of technology and the future of our dystopia. And as you will hear, we have some points in common. I'd say many points in common, but we also have some points of difference, which we dive into. So I found this to be an engaging conversation, not just about the book, but about different ways of looking at technology and where it is taking us in this society. So it's a very tectonic kind of conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. If you want to see a link to The Cloud Intern, you can go to the playlist at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and you'll see a link to the book on the publisher site, as you'll hear, and we'll talk about this as well. The publisher is called Under the BQE Press, which is an unusual organization we're going to learn more about. For now, let's go ahead and listen to the first half of my interview with debut novelist David Greenwood here on Tectonic. David Greenwood, welcome to Tectonic.
Oh, delighted to be here.
Great to have you. Let's talk about your new book, The Cloud Intern, which is your debut novel, published by Under the BQE Press. I'd call this book a dystopian sci-fi novel, but with a twist, which is that all of the action takes place in a rather utopian environment. The idea is that sometime in the future, after years of climate change and economic inequality, there's a billionaire floating above the blasted out landscape in a giant blimp, something called the Sky Yacht, which is like a billionaire's mega yacht, but floating in the air, supported by giant balloons. And as the book opens, we realize that we're reading the memoir of this billionaire, a guy named Chris Curtis. How did Chris end up riding around in the Sky Yacht?
First of all, I love that characterization of the book. Thank you. I actually never thought about it as a utopia floating within a dystopia. That's wonderful. He wound up floating around the Sky Yacht because he was childhood friends with a much more talented person who at the outset of the novel has died. So that was his co-founder in this company, Eddie. And the Sky Yacht is Eddie's corporate campus. And Chris Curtis has sort of so arranged things so that he does not have to really make contact with the Earth, with reality. He gets to be a sort of phantom up there on the Sky Yacht. He's not really involved in the daily affairs of the company. He's floating in a swimming pool and gazing at the clouds, at the sunrises, at the sunsets. But now with the death of the person who's the more technologically ingenious partner, he's sort of shoved into action as the Sky Yacht approaches this sort of Davos-like summit where some important world matters are supposed to be sorted out.
Okay, so the book opens right after the death of Wade Aubrey, the genius co-founder, as you said, of this company called Eddie. Chris obviously is in a state of shock, given that his close friend has just died. This book gives a portrait of a morose, almost reluctant billionaire who, as you just said, is floating around to this yacht, but he's trying to decide his path in life. It's interesting because tech billionaires don't always get the best press these days in the real world, least of all on my show. but here we have a rather sympathetic portrait of someone who has come into a lot of power and influence.
Yeah. And also within the cloud intern, Chris Curtis gets very bad press as well. There's a journalist up there interviewing him, continually failing to get a decent interview and eventually writing just a terrible smear piece on him. But he is a sympathetic person in that he's a person. And chances are, if we read, you know, pick your horrible tech lord, if we could read their diary, we would probably have some sympathy for them too. But he is not really a bad guy, even within the context of the book at all. He's, yeah, as you say, just a sort of depressed person who is trying to tolerate life like so many people.
I would love to read Mark Zuckerberg's diary. I mean, and see if he's sympathetic at all.
Exactly. That's that's the kind of writing exercise that you would get in a grad school program. You know, take your villain and you got to make them a non-villain somehow. Yeah.
Let's talk about the dystopia a little bit that you've built here. Chris Curtis is now the head of this company called Eddy. The Eddy is, as best I can tell, kind of like the iPhone of this world. It's some sort of a digital device that seems to have all the apps and it's addictive and it has captured the attention of the world. How did you imagine the Eddy looking physically? What is the Eddy?
I'm glad and not glad you asked that because I actually didn't picture it. I resisted picturing it. You know, you can't, it's hard to resist picturing it, but I didn't really want it to be a particular object. It's certainly like a phone in some way, and that everybody's looking down into it all the time, the same way they do with phones. But whether it actually looks like a phone or like some kind of sort of cubic vortex and it's in your hand that's showing you, you know, 3D things or whatever is up to you. I was strenuously vague in my own imaginings.
Well, that makes sense. That makes sense why there was not a specific description, because you were very detailed in your description of the sky yacht, how the balloons were oriented on the underside of this yacht and Chris Curtis's own fortress of solitude up on the top. But we never got a good description of the Eddy, and that makes sense why. But I know that it has some sort of visual output, some kind of a screen of some sort, because you do reference it at one point. I wanted to read a quick quote, because this helps set the stage, I think, for the kind of world that the Eddy inhabits now. Chris writes, "Most, I would say, even then, were just too ground into the troubles of their lives to attend to abstractions, the background radiation of doom coming in around the edges of their Eddy. Or they were convinced by those with a stake in convincing them that the foreboding was hype." So here you're writing about how the people of this world are consumed by the abstractions that are on the screen or whatever it is in this addictive device. And I love this phrase, the background radiation of doom coming in around the edges of their Eddy that maybe they're not fully attentive to. How does this world building you're doing here relate to how we see people today are consumed by their digital devices?
Alas, it's awfully similar, I would say. I mean, certainly there's a pretty heavy radiation of doom coming in, not around the edges, but through our devices now. But it's not necessarily the doom that you should be focused on. Even today, it's a very controlled doom that you're being fed through your device. And in the near future of Eddy, it's an even more controlled flow of maybe pseudo doom coming in. And it enables the people on the other side of the eddy, which is just about everyone, to possibly let slide the real serious matters that are shaping the world.
Well, this is one of the themes that keeps coming up in my conversations on this show, that there is a huge centralization of power in tech. People are distracted, they're addicted, they're diverted from more important matters, and that seems to play into the best interests of the people who are at the center of that tech power.
Yeah, that's, as Zoraida, the cloud intern, says in the book, we've been standardized, and there's a big benefit to standardizing people and their behavior if you want to make money from them, and if your job is creating the means by which to do that, your incentive is to do it as well as you can.
Well, let's talk about this character, Zoraida, because she is the cloud intern that's referenced in the title of the book. She's brought up as an intern to Chris Curtis and given some sort of vague job about weather or clouds. It's never totally clear what she should be doing, but she ends up being a major player in the book as she builds a friendship with Chris. It doesn't start as a friendship, but it develops. I hope that's not too much of a spoiler. But one of Zoraida's strong points is she has her own diary and her own epistolary relationships with other people that we get access to. We'll talk about that in a second, how we know about this. But she's very insightful about what's happening in the world. And writing about her observations of people being consumed by their eddy devices, she writes, "I see anesthetized people, not happy ones." I thought that was such a pithy statement of her world and our world. I mean, take any New York City subway or PATH train and look around and see the expressions on people's faces as they're deep into interaction with these surveillance devices. But elsewhere in the book, as you say, David, Zoraida writes that, quote, "we have been standardized." And she later in this missive, she writes something else, which I found very inspirational. Zoraida writes, "I want to see more weirdos." And I feel the same way. The smartphones or surveillance phones that so many people are addicted to, representing that centralized power we were just talking about, those devices push out conformist thought and action through to the rest of the world. And so Zoraida's right. We really do need weirdos to, as she says later, look at things that other people are not seeing.
Exactly. For example, in your PATH train trips or subway trips, with all those people huddled into their phones, look at how many people are looking out the window. Even when the train comes up from underground to go over the bridge into Manhattan, say, you're still the only person looking. I mean, even after all that time in the dark, and then there's spectacular Manhattan spread out before you, you're just like, can I get an inch of window here, please? Zoraida's position is that being a weirdo is not an apolitical position, that it's a vital position to participate in the world in the right way. And if you're getting the same information as everyone else, and if you're doing the same thing as everyone else, and even if, you know, you're getting completely different information from the other side, if there are two sides, everyone thinks they're right, even you have a coin flip chance of actually being right. And the way to be outside of that and get a better than coin flip chance is to have radically different inputs and to see more or see something different than what other people see. I heard recently on a podcast that there's some famous photograph of a rally during the Third Reich where there's just, you know, tens of thousands of people with their arms out and one guy just standing there like with his arms folded, who was later identified and is a known person now and was apparently put to death, not surprisingly. But you're not going to be that one person. If you're just doing the same things other people are doing and getting the same information that other people are getting, it's incredibly important to be that one person, and preferably more than one person, but you have to have radically different inputs and you have to see what other people aren't seeing.
Yeah, totally agree. I think that's a supremely important point about our world today, and echoed in this book, The Cloud Intern, that as people's worldviews become conformed to the wishes and the moldings of the tech oligarchs, it becomes even more important for some subset of people to express some independence. And honestly, a lot of the people listening to this show are listening to us via independent radio, independent non-commercial radio. And that, David, I feel like is one of the last oases left in our media environment that hasn't been steamrolled by, you know, Facebook and all of the rest of them. Let's talk about how we get access in this book to Zoraida's writing, and there's quite a bit of it. This is a very clever thing that you did in The Cloud Intern, in which Chris Curtis is drawing on his surveillance powers of all the data anywhere in the network inside the Sky Yacht. So we're getting a look at other characters' internal states, not from some kind of omniscient narrator, but via the technology in the book, the surveillance of their emails, their Eddy screen contents, and even being able to look through the camera on their Eddy to see the user as they're typing or talking or whatever. It's an interesting plot device that you've come up with.
Yeah, it's a crafty narrative trick, I suppose, to have this first-person narrator be able to access the thoughts and interior states of other characters as though a third-person narrator. And it's a creepy thing. And it's actually, of course, I'm sure I don't have to tell you, a very technologically possible thing. But in the book, it enables Chris to continually have these conversations with his intern, in which he has to dissimulate not having read her private documents and not knowing anywhere near as much about her as he does. It's probably not giving too much away to say that she's not there with totally peaceable intentions, and that he might be in considerable danger from her, and the yacht itself might be. So it's important for him to look at this stuff in theory, to look at her private documents. And so that's how he excuses it to himself.
Yeah, reading this, it puts, I think, the reader in an interesting position in that we're seeing a tech billionaire conduct unwarranted surveillance on someone else in order for his own self-preservation and the preservation of his floating yacht. And the reader thinks, wait, am I supposed to be rooting for this guy? This billionaire who's trying to protect his mega yacht by conducting surveillance. But he is a sympathetic character, as we said earlier, in certain ways. It's not a clean-cut line between who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. You get a sense of people's cross purposes and how there might be a way to bridge that divide later on.
Yeah, I certainly don't think of him as a villain at all. And if you can sympathize with him, I think I'll take that as a great compliment, because it seems like you would be a harder case in the reading audience. I mean, to be honest, Chris is much more similar to me than any of the other characters in the book. Not in that I'm a tech lord spying on people, although I am a professional software engineer, but just in his personality, in his problems, in a lot of his relationship to the world, he finds himself in this position. And I guess he was more driven there by, you know, certain melancholy weaknesses in his character than by any kind of serious malevolence or any remote desire to control the world.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with David Greenwood, author of his debut novel, which is called The Cloud Intern. We're hearing or we just heard in the first half of the interview about some of the major characters and threads of the book. And in the second half of the interview, you're going to hear we broaden the conversation to talk more about how these themes are reflected in our real dystopia all around us today, and how David and I see some parts of that a little bit differently. So I hope you enjoy that. Let's go ahead now and listen to the second half of my interview with David Greenwood, author of The Cloud Intern, here on Tectonic.
There's another technology that you have imagined in this book, which is something you call the celebrity emu. Emu here, E-M-U, is short for emulation, and it resembles more or less these AI avatars that we have in the real world today, in which celebrities or some companies are now bringing back avatars of, in a very creepy move, of dead relatives who can have pseudo conversations with people through AI. I find the whole thing really distasteful and disturbing. But you talk about the onset of celebrity emus in this book. Chris is writing about them and says, quote, "People did develop deep, enduring relationships with these things. The success took us by surprise. At first, we'd paid great sums for the rights to emulate celebrity participants, not anticipating that in a short time, public emus would become an indispensable element of fame, even a prerequisite. If you didn't make yourself available this way, you essentially didn't exist." How much were you inspired by the current spate of AI avatars when you came up with this emu idea?
Not at all, because I wrote this before LLMs emerged. So I was certainly not inspired by what's happening right now, but it seems like something that is going to happen. It's inevitable, but I did not expect it so soon, I must admit. And besides the celebrity emus, the Eddie is used to talk to just emus of anybody. Chris Curtis's main confidant and friend is an emu of his dad, who's not even actually dead. He just prefers to talk to the emu of his dad than his actual dad. And the cloud intern Zoraida's more or less only confidant and friend is an emu of her former self, who sort of goads her on as her resolve starts to fail later on in the book.
Well, I find that very interesting that you were not inspired by these current AI avatars. You nailed it. I mean, these things have launched and very closely resemble what you write about in the book. Can you talk a little bit about your world building? How did you go about imagining all of the different elements of the Eddie, the emus, the sorts of surveillance, and the general feel of a world ravaged by big technology companies? How did you go about putting that together?
I would say that the circumstance of the world in the book is one of the less fanciful elements, in that it all seems to me inevitable based on the current trajectory of the world, or at least it's the probable outcome in the various dimensions. So just running climate issues ahead by a few years, running social issues ahead by a few years, and running technology ahead a few years. And it just seemed like that's where we're going. Some of the stuff, like, I guess maybe at the time it could be seen that tech CEOs or tech overlords, if you will, would play such an outsized role in society, was something that was coming to the fore. I'm not sure if I had some prescience there, if that was already obvious. But with the emus, I just had that idea, I think, around the time that smartphones became very prevalent, an idea of someday this phone is going to be able to capture the personality of the person who's talking, and that someday you'll have the option of not even knowing if you're talking to your mom or an emulation of your mom, say.
Oh, that is a sad thought.
Yeah, it was a sad thought. And I wanted to, and I was just like, there's something sad and touching about this, that you could choose not to know if somebody even died, say if like your son was fighting overseas and you were just like, let me just keep talking to him forever.
Yeah, I think that's actually happening, and that people are developing relationships, even though intellectually they know that these are just algorithms. There have been a number of news stories when companies have made changes to the underlying code that changes the personality of the avatar. People get really upset because they felt like this was a real relationship. So unfortunately, I think we are headed into that future. I don't find the treatment of emus exciting or positive in any way. I find them sadly true to life, and I'm sorry to see the world head down this perhaps inevitable road.
Yeah. I mean, I can see cases where it's the best option, and that's a sad case. But it's probably nonetheless going to be the case that there are people who simply don't have a friend, or who simply don't have a loved one surviving, even one in the world. And, you know, if you're off in a nursing home and people aren't visiting you and so on, it could be an enormous boon to have something that feels like a friend, either someone in particular who you want from your former life, or just someone who's there for you. Of course, that is sad, but it may be the less sad option for some people. So there's that. But I would say in general, it is not what I want to happen. I want there to be more human connection, not for AI to usurp human connection as happens in the cloud in turn. And Zoraida points out at some point that hers is the first generation that grew up talking to emus more than real people. And she's very uncomfortable, even just like talking to her classmates in between class. And I think something like that is almost in progress.
Once again, we need weirdos. We need the weirdos who are willing and able to talk to humans and take their faces out of the screens in order to do so. I want to quote what novelist Helen Phillips had to say about The Cloud Intern. She wrote that this book is evocative of surveillance and startup culture run amok, which I thought was a good description. Listeners may remember that Helen was on the show a while back talking about her novel, Hum, another dystopian novel. And one of the things I appreciated about Helen's book was that in the endnotes, she listed the books and articles that she drew on for her research in her world building. David, were you inspired by any authors or journalists as you wrote The Cloud Intern?
Yes, I would say. Not deliberately, but I think I can see the trace of, and this will sound perhaps unexpected and weird, but the English early to mid 20th century comic fountain P.G. Wodehouse and his Blanding's Castle sagas, and also some of the Bertie and Jeeves stories. Chris Curtis sort of wants to live in that world, and he's annoyed that his personal assistant, which he's actually not sure is a real person or not, can't behave more like Jeeves, the butler of Bertie Wooster in the P.G. Wodehouse books. And he himself is sort of living a bit of a Blanding's Castle idol that, of course, unlike in a P.G. Wodehouse book, doesn't last and doesn't necessarily turn out just fine. So I would say in the world building, weirdly, it was P.G. Wodehouse. And other than that, the research that I did for the book was, I must say, pretty minimal, but I did read a lot of anarchist material and read about Emma Goldman and Lucy Parsons and so on. That stuff that I was not familiar with, but that Zoraida is familiar with. So I had to brush up on that. I guess, I mean, because I was a computer science major and I have a day job as a software engineer, I didn't really have to do too much research as far as the technological things go, but I guess you could call that research as well.
Well, I loved the literary references. The Wodehouse references, and there were a few, clearly establish you as a Wodehouse fan. There was also a mention of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. There's a reference of Moby Dick, and big points for referencing Austerlitz by Sebald, who's one of my favorite authors. That was a deep cut, and I was happy to see Sebald mention.
Oh, man, I'm so delighted to hear you spot that. Yes.
Well, speaking of books, I want to say a word about your publisher under the BQE Press, which calls itself a Brooklyn-based collective of writers, artists, and musicians, and you're listed on the website. What does it mean to be published by a collective?
It's an interesting new model, and let's hope it works and proliferates, in which the idea is that writers and artists might be better positioned than, you know, editors at big companies to have their pulse on the zeitgeist or on the moment socially, aesthetically. And each writer who's published by the press is tasked with acquiring a further title for the press. So unless you agree to that, you can't be published. And that's the model. And so you become an editor when you become a writer for the press.
And then outside of being published by under the BQE, you said you're also a software engineer. This is a question I've asked a bunch of guests over the years, but you're in tech, David, and you've been in tech for a while, I guess. Are you hopeful for the future? I mean, specifically what tech is doing to society and everything else. You're seeing this both as a novelist now, but also from the inside as a practitioner yourself. How do you feel about the future of tech and society?
Yeah, someone recently asked me if I was afraid of AI, and my answer was that I've been a lot nicer to ants lately. And I actually have that in mind now whenever I see a spider in my house and just leave it alone. I do feel that we're going to be, if not somehow antipathetic to superior intelligence, probably ancillary or irrelevant to that intelligence. And it will just be nice if we manage to persist. However, an interesting notion is that we, at least, and we're the only evidence we have, tend to be pretty reverent toward a creator if we believe in a creator. And so it's possible that we can instill some reverence in their creator to whatever AI supplants us as the smartest entities. So there's that hope. But as far as more down to earth things, like just the, you know, the daily life of a person as technology advances, it seems that there are some points of optimism that could be scrounged, such as you probably noticed that the new Google AR glasses were announced today. And those glasses are going to probably supplant the phone in one form, you know, in the relatively near future. And in some way, that's creepy. And in some way, as a person who is tired of people just completely ignoring the world in favor of staring down into this little vortex, I kind of think that's an improvement. I suspect you disagree, but you know, the glasses will be able to do all the things a phone can do, and that they can surveil the world, you know, maybe a little bit better. But I do look forward to people being able to look around rather than look down. So there's that little ray of hope. And I suppose that in education, I think that technology will enable kids to have a much better time learning than they have for a long, long time now, going to school and having to just sort of be subject to a harried person just trying to keep, you know, the cats inside the enclosure while imparting some information that is not necessarily imparted at the speed that the kid would ideally learn at. So I think that is a good point, or something that could potentially be positive in the trajectory of technology. And I think a lot of people are it's just not going to be economically feasible to support a world full of people basically pretending to be machines, which is what we've been doing for over a century now. The machines are going to be the machines, and we are going to have to stop pretending to be machines and become and either become humans or something else. So if we can stop being machines all day and become humans again, that would be nice. It's not necessarily going to happen.
Well, that's I'm trying to figure out how to respond to all that because you gave us a lot of material there. You've got super intelligence from the AI side. You have surveillance glasses that you're listing some positives for, changes in education and the labor force. All I can say is I hope that if these things take place, that we will see some positive developments. But I want to acknowledge that you said I probably disagree because I think I disagree with everything you just said. Respectfully.
Can I ask?
Yes, please.
Do you disagree in the probability of any of that coming about, or that even if it did, that it would be a positive thing?
Well, it depends on the. I don't think super intelligence is coming. There are too many structural problems with LLMs, starting with their lack of any understanding, any intrinsic understanding of what's happening to show a path towards superintelligence. I like a lot what Gary Marcus writes along these lines, that there's got to be some neurosymbolic aspect to AI and its foundations before we can even conceive of going towards that. How we're building it right now, basically just on data, is not going to do it. Is my belief. I'm not an expert though. I'm just a generalist.
Yeah, I'm not an expert either, and I actually do prefer the interpretation that just like the transformer model, you know, souped up to the max and fed with a maximum of data is not going to be enough to, you know, have a step function change in the intelligence, and that some further, you know, algorithmic development will be required for that. But it also seems relatively likely that that further algorithmic development will happen. So
it could, but you know, the Ouroboros is starting to eat itself. They're starting to ingest their own output, and some studies are showing that quality is already starting to decay a little bit. But I don't know. These are early days. Nobody knows where AI is headed, really. I think it's more just opinion and faith at this point, where people put their bets. In terms of education and Google's surveillance glasses, maybe those changes come about, and if they do, I just have a hard time seeing those as positive developments. It's kind of like what you said earlier about the AI avatars in nursing homes. What a sad state if all we can give our elders is virtual reality helmets.
And it's a sad state of affairs in, you know, public education and probably even private education that, you know, an AI tutor might be vastly superior in the experience of a student. But, you know, it would be much nicer, I suppose, if we could find a way to make, you know, just human interaction or even, you know, human / nature interaction the education that it should be. But there's the evil and lesser evil, maybe.
Well, there's a book out now called The AI Con by Emily Bender and Alex Hanna that talks to this specific issue. And they're going to be on the show soon talking about it. And I agree with their position, which is that if we need more teachers who have more time with students, we should be funding teachers more rather than...
Oh, I agree. I certainly agree with that, too. I certainly agree with that, too.
I appreciate this conversation, David, because as we're talking about earlier, conformity is not the answer. Having one way of looking at the world is not going to get us through this. We need to have different perspectives and a way of talking and expressing different worldviews to build something, some amalgam of good ideas to bring us forward. And I think this book, The Cloud Intern, is one example of that. You've provided a view of the world, a dystopian view, that has a sympathetic portrait of someone who I would not normally have any sympathy for. But a very thoughtful work here. Again, it's called The Cloud Intern, published by Under the BQE Press by my guest today, David Greenwood. David, thanks so much again for being on the show.
Oh, thank you. It was a great delight.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining, almost 20 minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with David Greenwood, author of the debut novel, The Cloud Intern. And as you heard, it has a lot to say, and through the book, David has a lot to say about what's coming down the pike in terms of technology, surveillance technology, addictive screens, AI avatars, and the fate of society that is ruled by centralized power in the hands of just a very few owners and investors in big tech companies. I mean, as he said, you don't have to do a whole lot of work to imagine this kind of dystopia. You just take what's happening already and you extend your view by a few years, and there you have it. By the way, I wanted to say as a side note, we mentioned Helen Phillips, who was on the show not long ago with her book called Hum, that was also a dystopian book. I went through, there's a list of books linked from the Tectonic homepage, all the books that I've covered in this almost 8-year run of the show. If you go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, there's a link to the list of books maintained by listener volunteer Chris. Thank you for maintaining that list. And I found that The Cloud Intern by David Greenwood is the 10th dystopian novel that I have covered. Yes, I think we should get a prize for covering 10, count them, 10 novels. They're not all, the novels are not all pure dystopia, but they all have at least some dystopian themes. So most recently was Hum by Helen Phillips. Also not too long ago was Same Bed, Different Dreams by Ed Park. We had The Candy House by Jennifer Egan. A while ago we had Jonathan Lethem on talking about his book The Arrest, which was fun. Paul Bradley Carr wrote 1414 Degrees. David Yoon brought us Version Zero. The Australian author Dennis Glover wrote Factory 19. That was a lot of fun. Paul Kingsnorth wrote Alexandria. That was part of a trilogy of books, and that one was the really dystopian one. And Tim Mon wrote Infinite Detail. All those are worth taking a look at, in addition to The Cloud Intern. If you're interested in diving into some of these dystopian topics. And as we talked about with David, one of the main themes that I took away, one of the main messages I took away from The Cloud Intern, was that, as the quote says in the book, I want to see more weirdos. We need more weirdos. We need more nonconformists who are willing to, as the book said, see what others can't see. Because after all, so many people have buried their faces into screens that are owned and operated by 5 big tech companies that basically run the world at this point. The minority of people who are willing to look elsewhere, that minority is going to be increasingly important for the survival of our species. People who do not have their faces buried in a screen have the ability, consequently, to see what others can't see. They can see the world. I mean, literally and metaphorically, they can see the world a lot better than the people who are being programmed, essentially, by these corporate devices. Now, I hasten to add that I don't blame the people who have their faces buried in their screens, because the screens have been developed by the most highly trained psychologists in the world, who are being paid exorbitant sums of money to make the screens hard to look away from. So for people who are addicted to their socials or their slot machine games or whatever it is that people are doing on their phones, those phones are operating as designed. And one of the outcomes of that design is for the great majority of people not to see what is happening all around them. And that was another theme in The Cloud Intern, that people are so addicted to and taken in by this Eddy device, basically the surveillance phone of that world, that they're not seeing the larger issues of climate change, social upheaval, political injustice, and so on. Again, it matches very closely where we're headed, really where we already are in this world. And so the nonconformists are really important. And you, listener, you listening to this weirdo show, because I proudly stand with and count myself among the weirdos, and I'm trying to maintain my weirdness by not being taken in too much by the conformist pressures of this tech, finance, media glop that just pervades everything. And you listening to this show, you too are one of the weirdos. You're listening to a weird show. You're listening on independent radio, which, as I said to David in the interview, is one of the supremely important oases in modern life, is that we have some independent voices. Well, certainly not just my show. I mean, so many voices out there who are not being manipulated, controlled, and predetermined by those five companies in Silicon Valley. It's so important that we have some independence from big tech and their Wall Street partners. And part of that weirdo-ness is not just being able to see what others can't see. That's a big part of it. But a flip side of that, that's another benefit, is not being seen so much by those same companies of centralized power. Being able to opt out to some extent of the big tech surveillance that's coming at us is also very valuable and really essential for us to maintain some sliver of privacy, some sliver of escape from the big tech surveillance engine. And that is about to get much, much harder. As David mentioned, recently Google announced that unfortunately, the product known as Google Glass, which we thought was dead, has come back like the worst kind of zombie from a zombie movie. It's back. This undead force of Google Glass has returned. And this time, Google is partnering with a company to make it look a lot less horribly geeky. And remember back in, I think it was 2013, Google launched Google Glass and nobody wanted to wear it because it looked so dorky. We talked about this on last week's show with Chris Gilliard. You can listen to our comments about Google Glass. But anyway, it's back. And in order to make it look less dorky, Google has partnered with Warby Parker, which is an eyewear company that's known for pretty good design, pretty good frame design. And I'm sorry to see them selling out to Google. Google has invested $75 million into Warby Parker. So Google is now a part owner of Warby Parker in the same way that Facebook has partnered so closely with Ray-Ban. So as I said last week with Chris Gilliard, that I don't want to wear Ray-Ban anymore because I might be mistaken for someone wearing the Facebook spy glasses. I also don't want to wear Warby Parker, because I don't want, soon enough, there's going to be Google Glass surveillance specs watching you, listening to you, recording you with a Warby Parker logo on it. And I don't want anyone to think maybe they're being recorded because here's this guy wearing Warby Parker glasses or sunglasses. They make glasses and sunglasses. And it's best if we don't wear Warby Parker or Ray-Ban, as far as I'm concerned, because those are companies that have partnered with big tech to vastly expand the surveillance powers of those grossly unethical companies and putting our society at risk, as I've been saying for years. And they're not all what Google and Facebook are doing. There's now also Apple, which is, people think, is going to make an announcement at some point that they're going to have their own surveillance glasses coming out. Everyone is getting in on the party, and it's not just Facebook and Google and Apple. Now it's OpenAI as well. OpenAI, which is partly owned by Microsoft. And Sam Altman, the CEO, somehow engineered this incredible press hit between him and Johnny Ive, who used to be the chief designer for Apple, now is independent. And, was independent until Sam Altman bought Johnny Ive's design company for $6 billion. in order to bring Johnny Ive. How's that for a signing bonus to come into OpenAI? And why does Sam Altman want Johnny Ive so much? The reason is because Sam Altman needs more surveillance data. Sam Altman knows that ChatGPT has already ingested the entire web, and they need more surveillance data. That is the only way they can continue growth at any cost. So they want to outfit everybody with a surveillance device. These are not surveillance glasses. This is kind of a some sort of a little oval device that you're going to pin onto your shirt. It's not clear yet. There's some sketches online of what this might look like. But it's something that you're going to attach to your clothes, and it's going to have a camera and a microphone attached, and it's going to be watching everyone around you and listening to everything you say and they say. And I'm saying you as though you're going to wear it, but Tectonic listeners, I know you're not going to buy one of these things, but you're still at risk. Because if anybody in earshot wears one of those things in your presence, anything you say in the presence of that person wearing that surveillance device, be it the OpenAI device or the Facebook glasses or the Google glasses or the Apple glasses, all of that goes straight into the cloud. And I don't mean some ethereal, fluffy little white cloud of computing utopia out there. I mean the hardware that's owned by the five most powerful and most unethical companies in human history that have deep ties to every third party you may not want to share your data with. Anything you say, anyone you're with, anything you do, any action you take is all going to be recorded and analyzed and stored indefinitely in the network of super data centers that are now drawing down the power and the fresh water in this country and worldwide. It's quite a deal that they are going to try to sell us. Put on this surveillance gear, whether it's the Facebook glasses, the Google glasses, the Apple glasses, the Sam Altman surveillance puck that they're going to make a huge press push for you. Only the cool people put the surveillance puck on their clothes. Don't you want to be one of the cool people? They're all going to be doing this. And in return, they are going to surveil you, me, your family, your neighbors, your friends, your community. Everyone within earshot is going to be surveilled, tracked, analyzed, and stored, and calculated, and manipulated, and controlled indefinitely while they draw down our energy and fresh water. It's a terrible deal. None of us should buy any of these surveillance devices, and we should use our energy and our creativity to ridicule them mercilessly until they are 6 feet under and we salt the earth so that nothing ever grows in there ever again. Anyway, that's my two cents. So I hope you enjoy this wonderful reading that I have come up, that I've recommended to you here in these comments. And I'll read this one last clip. Speaking of this Johnny Ive, Sam Altman surveillance device, this crazy left-wing rag called The Wall Street Journal wrote a piece that's essentially warning us. Of course, I'm joking here, but the Wall Street Journal wrote a good piece covering the Sam Altman Johnny Ive partnership, talking about the capabilities of the surveillance puck, and Gary Marcus, who I brought up, the AI expert who I brought up in the interview, wrote a comment about this, and he wrote the following: a camera and microphone. You would be monitored all the time. Everything you say, everything you do, not just recorded, but analyzed, interpreted, and turned into data, which, of course, OpenAI trained their models on. Didn't I tell you OpenAI was going to shift into surveillance? Dictators everywhere will love it. And when you've got AI expert Gary Marcus giving you warnings that sound a whole lot like what you get from Tectonic, you know we are at a new level of red alert warning. So, friends, all I can tell you is the homework I've got for you until next time. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. And for our outro, there's this new album out by Stereolab, their first album in a number of years, and there's one track on the album that's called aerial troubles. And I thought that would be perfectly pertinent to my guest, David Greenwood, and his book, The Cloud Intern. I hope you have a great week, everybody. I'll see you next time.
Yes, indeed. Welcome to another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Welcome. Hope if you are on this side of the Atlantic Ocean, you had an enjoyable three-day weekend. Federal holidays are a dirty word, a dirty phrase here on this program. We don't take no stinking holidays. So I'm here as usual, but I hope you had some time off, a day off today. And I have tons of good music for you this evening. Maybe too much, perhaps too much good music for you. It's like, you know, there's that trick job interview question. What's your greatest weakness, right? And the answer is, you know, I just work too damn hard. I'm too conscientious. I'm too good a worker. This is a big problem. So I'm going to say similarly, I have too much good music tonight, and I might cause a fire at WFMU's transmitter in West Orange. That's how good the show that I have prepared for you tonight is. We're going to start with music from a guy named Evan House. House with an A, H-A-U-S-E. Evan is a composer based right here in New Jersey, and interesting, does interesting, I would say, sort of hybrid work, classical slash rock. Definitely, I would definitely call him, you know, a composer with a capital C. He himself is a multi-instrumentalist, and his music features the full panoply of classical and rock instruments. Evan plays, I think, guitar, bass, keyboards, God knows what else. We're going to hear a track from an album released in 2018 called Plastic Island Pentecost, and this will be a piece called Metempsychosis. This is music from Evan House.